presentan al mundo la antorcha olímpica, se ha transformado en una lección de derechos humanos para la Unión Americana. Beatriz Salas amplía la información.
Decidir sobre quiénes serán los portadores de la antorcha en la ceremonia inaugural de los Juegos Olímpicos de invierno en Pekín es la responsabilidad de China, y Estados Unidos no está en posición de hacer comentarios despectivos. Así respondió Pekín a la reciente interferencia de Washington, quien aseveró que la elección de China del atleta de la etnia Uyghur, Denijir Dilamujian, para llevar la antorcha olímpica es un esfuerzo de Pekín para distraer la atención del llamado genocidio en la región de Xinjiang.
Los llamados comentarios de genocidio de Estados Unidos son la gran mentira del siglo y exponen su intento de politizar los Juegos Olímpicos de invierno y su siniestra intención de utilizar el tema relacionado con Xinjiang para difamar a China.
China asimismo acusó a Estados Unidos de mentir de manera descarada sobre las minorías étnicas, mientras olvida sistemáticamente discriminaciones en su propio suelo.
Estados Unidos llevó a cabo un genocidio contra los nativos americanos en el pasado y ha discriminado sistemáticamente a las minorías raciales a largo plazo. La población de nativos americanos se ha desplomado de 5 millones a finales del siglo XV a unos 250 mil a principios del siglo XX, reduciéndose a una vigésima parte. ¿Qué es el genocidio? Las políticas que Estados Unidos ha impuesto a los nativos americanos son un verdadero genocidio.
Zhao, además de criticar la discriminación racial contra los africanos y asiáticos en Estados Unidos, dijo que elegir a un atleta de la etnia Uyghur muestra que la política de China de promover los deportes de invierno y mejorar la salud de las personas está beneficiando a individuos de todos los grupos étnicos y prueba que no existe discriminación.
Lo que Estados Unidos debería estar haciendo es revisar cuidadosamente sus propios crímenes históricos contra los nativos americanos y tomar medidas concretas para reducir la discriminación racial contra estas personas y otras minorías raciales, como los africanos y asiáticos.
China, en reiteradas ocasiones, ha instado a Estados Unidos a dejar de usar los asuntos vinculados con Xinjiang para difundir mentiras, interferir en los asuntos internos de China o intentar detener el desarrollo del país. Advierte que, de lo contrario, Pekín dará una respuesta más contundente a la luz del desarrollo de la situación. Beatriz Salas con información de Niloufar Shakuri, Hispan TV Noticias.
Migrantes de todos los rincones del mundo duermen bajo su mismo cielo estrellado. Me los encuentro en las calles, en los cines, en los supermercados, y el olor de sus comidas me embriaga de placer. Todos ellos son mis vecinos.
Y yo aquí vivo, bajo sus leyes domésticas, pago impuestos y mis manos producen la riqueza nacional.
Soy parte de esa comunidad que vive, trabaja y sueña con una mañana mejor para nuestras familias.
Casi todos migrantes como yo, casi todos soñadores como yo.
Trabajemos pues en la construcción de otra nación que nos haga dignos.
Seamos los arquitectos de nuestro sueño colectivo.
Esta radio no tiene comerciales porque tú nos apoyas. Si ya has hecho una aportación económica, te damos las gracias. Si no, hazlo ahora en kpfk.org o llama al 818-985-5735.
Así llegamos al final de esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro más profundo agradecimiento a todos los medios y personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
They told me, you know, we'll give you a day, we'll give you a week, however long it takes for you to accept our help to be healed and to become a child of God and denounce being gay.
Honoring the memory of Dr. Anonymous, coming up on the Rainbow Minute.
I got three quarters of the way through several times and was like, well, I have no idea how this would end, so I have to start over. But one thing I know is I can't end a story without hope.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Nicaragua's NGO Purge targets its oldest queer group. Gay Taiwanese movie sings out a universal love song and upending the artistic process with Amanda Kayback. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Joe Bainline.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending August 28, 2021. The government of Nicaragua is aiming to shut down the country's oldest LGBTQ advocacy group. The Interior Ministry has asked the National Assembly to annul the legal nonprofit status of Fundación Xaquiquetzal and 14 other non-governmental organizations. President.
You got to go to the Lonesome Valley. You.
Oh, living in the United States, it is our responsibility to resist the injustices done by our government in our names. Not in our name will you wage endless war. There can be no more deaths, no more transfusions of blood for oil. Not in our name will you invade countries, bomb civilians, kill more children, letting history take its course over the graves of the nameless. Not in our names will you erode the very freedoms you have claimed to fight for. Not by our hands will we supply weapons and funding for the annihilation of families on foreign soil. Not by our mouths will we let fear silence us. Not by our hearts will we allow whole peoples or countries to be deemed evil. Not by our will and not in our name. We pledge resistance. We pledge alliance with those who have undergone attack for voicing opposition to the war or for their religion or ethnicity. We pledge to make common cause with the people of the world to bring about justice, freedom, and peace. Another world is possible, and we pledge to make it real.
Economists have defined the economic health of a country by its gross domestic product. Trouble is, every time a forest falls, the GDP goes up. With every oil spill, the GDP goes up. Every time a cancer patient is diagnosed, the GDP goes up. Is this how we measure economic progress? Economists must learn to subtract.
Graffiti until he meets the land I stand on. I in my darkened threshold and pawing through my pockets the receipts, the bus schedules, urgent napkin poems, and matchbook phone numbers, all of which laundering is rendered pulpy and strange.
And lurking your way next on the stream or the archives, whichever you're listening to, it's Free Radio Santa Cruz's Bathrobes Pier's broadsides for July 29th. No, June 29th, actually. And it's, what do we got? We got a long interview with Reggie Meisler on the
latest implications of the oversized vehicle ordinance and the shitty council meeting that happened day before yesterday, and a few other surprises. This is normally a flashback time on Thursday, but we're trying to actually add a little something contemporary just because. It would be nice to do something that has some more direct current relevance. So let's see if that works. Here we go.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So at, well, last Tuesday, there was a afternoon city council meeting that had a number of sort of minor surprises, unfortunately nothing major or real in terms of a change in the situation for folks outside living in their vehicles or on the ground or poor people in Santa Cruz generally that I could see. Appropriations were passed for the Tier 3 program for those lucky 20 vehicles who are able to get into it and so avoid what is soon to be criminalization throughout Santa Cruz at night of oversized vehicles starting in about a month, because this was also at the same city council meeting that the second reading of the oversized vehicle ordinance took place. And that sort of seals the doom of folks who are in their vehicles who have been protected by the Coastal Commission for the last, what, 5 or 6 years from that, the fate of harassment, ticketing, hostility by neighbors, and essentially exclusion from Santa Cruz, not just at night, really, and not just from the coastal zone, but throughout the entire city, putting them in a position where they have to move all the time, not just every 72 hours, as is currently the state law. It may also be a part of a city ordinance, too. But every day, and they can only get permits if they can get them at all, for a very limited number of days a month, and even then they have to move every day. It's a pretty horrible situation, and there's no relief for the majority of folks who are in oversized vehicles, as clarified by the Evan Morrison of the Free Guides Overlook program, where he has been taking vehicles he's full up, and he has a stuffed waiting list. So may have even been closed. I'm not sure what the current status of it is. Anyway, let's get into this, and hopefully you'll get some new information and some new ammunition to fire back at the city councils and the city mangler, the city manager, Matt Huffaker, and his latest antics as the machine grinds onward. Okay, well, today's the 28th of June, 2023. I'm on the phone with Reggie Meisler, who is a, gosh, Santa Cruz Cares activist, independent activist, active activist. What exactly are you there, Reggie?
I guess, I don't know.
I take it you're also kind of a follower of the Santa Cruz Shitty Council, as I like to call them. Yesterday they met, and they had a long afternoon session. I was surprised by some of the stuff they did, or I should say by the actions of Mayor Fred Keeley. But and I heard you call in at one point on one of the consent agenda items, but I got wearied after about 2 or 3 hours of this and took off. But I think you may have stayed later.
Yeah, I stayed for the 5-year plan.
So that was mid-afternoon, yeah. Or?
What's that?
That was in the mid-afternoon, more or less?
Yeah, gosh. I think that happened at like 4:15 because they kind of put it at the end of the agenda, even though it wasn't quite at the end.
Mm-hmm. So were you listening to most of the meeting yourself?
I was, yeah.
Or did you take a bathroom break?
Oh, yeah. Well, I definitely took breaks here and there. My wife, Jess, was listening in, too, because she wanted to comment on that 5-year plan agenda item, too.
I don't even think I've read the 5-year plan. Usually when I hear that, I immediately start zoning out the words plan, 5-year plan, housing plans. They got lots of them. And usually it doesn't involve much that has to do with actually really accessible income or even shelter for people who are poor and need it most. That's been my general reaction, though probably some of it is a form of bias and prejudice. But tell me about this 5-year plan that they were proposing, why you thought it was worth waiting for, and so forth.
Well, it talked about the high-level homelessness response, which was not interesting. I mean, it was very high-level, very sort of like, we're just going to do all the things. And so that part was not that interesting. Probably worth calling out the city on just how sort of out of touch and not connected to reality their supposed 5-year plan was. I think the thing that I was really interested in, my wife, in calling in about is under the public safety slide, the city called out that they were going to investigate the feasibility and funding of a regional public safety training center. And for people who, like, are following Stop Cop City in Georgia, in the Wilani Forest, where they're building this giant compound for a police training center that seems to be, like, focused partially on urban warfare. And there's a huge coalitional uprising against that project. It really feels like that is something that they're basically trying to do in Santa Cruz, because similar to Atlanta, Santa Cruz has, in the county, this big foresty area, which they might want to try to build some crazy public, basically the police training center that they sort of, like, obscure by saying that, oh, well, EMTs and fire departments also train there.
And what kind of appropriations are they proposing, or were they proposing? Is this being done in alone or in conjunction with other pro-police state agencies? What are we looking at?
Very unclear. You know, the funny thing is, city staff, when presenting this stuff, they basically just read a few bullet points on each slide, not even all the bullet points, and they skipped over that particular bullet point, so we have no details. We have no understanding of what the funding is, what the feasibility is, what the purpose of this is. Apparently, it wasn't important enough for them to even summarize in a sentence or two. But it's worthy enough to, like, be part of our 5-year plan and to somehow come up with funding for it. So it is, that's not a good look to me that, like, this is going to be, you know, I think that this is going to be something to keep on our radars.
How much time did this 5-year plan discussion take up?
It was very, you know, it was relatively quick. I mean, it really felt like city staff just slapped this thing together. Because even the city council was like, this lacks specificity. This is like, there's too many bullet points, but at the same time, they're too vague. you know. And I think the funniest thing is the most amount of time spent in discussing this entire five-year plan was city council basically hand-wringing and sort of like freaking out that the mission statement of this whole five-year plan was discover your joy in Santa Cruz or something like that. And I think what they realized is that this is obviously like free propaganda for Joy Schendelbecker's next city council run. And so there was just so much embarrassing, like, oh, joy? I don't, you know, that word, I don't like that word. Could we use happiness, maybe? You know, I'm just realizing that word's not good. And just back and forth and back and forth about not liking this word. That was what most of the conversation was about. So, pretty ridiculous.
So, was there an actual vote on any issue? Was any money appropriated or any direction given to staff?
No, so far this is just a meaningless document of vision statement, even though they said that this is supposed to be the step after a vision statement. But I just thought it was important to comment on because it seemed like they were trying to sneak in sort of our own local cop city.
How many people spoke about the issue, either by phone or in person?
It was just me, Joy, and my wife, Jazz. Oh, wait, here, I got to take a call. Here, let me, I'll get back in just a second.
Okay, you're back. When I looked at the agenda, and I'm looking at it again now, I noticed five items. I actually didn't see the first one until Mayor Keeley, of all people, brought it up. I think he raised it. But the items that I found of interest were the update of the city council policies, the city emergency shelter operations and management contract, which is the Armory and the Salvation Army's management. Actually, it's the Overlook and Armory program. The three safe parking operations, meaning actually the one safe parking operation, the very limited Tier 3 operation, that's item 12. Then there was item 22, which was the permit fees related to oversized ordinance, vehicle ordinance. And I think you commented on one or two of these. And I commented on a couple of them. And then finally there was the actual second reading of the OVO as amended, which essentially cements it into place. As far as I was concerned, I was going to bring it up again, but I didn't think it was worth waiting for to repeat myself, which was, because I've already said it a couple times, you know, to the community and the city council, which wasn't really...
The hour of 10:45 having arrived.
Hang on, that's Fred Keeley interrupting us.
The meeting is called to order, and the clerk will call the roll.
Thank you, Mayor.
My God, you can't shut that guy up. He's everywhere. And actually, I have to say, Keeley was unusually responsive in at least a superficial way to the need for more public comment. I don't know if you noticed that, if you were watching the early parts of the consent agenda. Were you there for that part of it?
Yeah, you know, Keeley, I think since he got into office, has been very pro-public comment relative to other people. I don't know that he's pro anything else, but he's pro public comment.
Well, I get the feeling if he feels he has the agenda kind of sewn up, or if he feels he has control of things, and I'm not sure if he does actually feel that way, or even if that's an accurate assessment of his position of what if he does have control. Then he doesn't have to worry about, you know, public comment is sort of a frilly thing. And I think one of the issues that came up, you know, people raised the issue about oral communication. Is it going to be at the beginning of the usually non-existent evening sessions, or is it going to be at a time certain in the afternoon, or is it going to be at both, or at the end of a time uncertain, which is their usual approach now, because it's most convenient for them, I imagine. At the end of the afternoon agenda, which so you don't know when the hell you get a chance to speak about, or I should say squeak, because I don't think you have really much time to speak. You get 2 minutes rather than the 3 minutes they allow on agenda items. And they're also eliminating group comment time as well if this new city council policy goes into effect, which I guess it did. They passed it with Sandy Brown voting in favor, I believe, a unanimous vote. My point was that they need to have a public hearing on all this stuff, because there's an elaborate series of, it looked like at least one change, which Keeley picked up on. I'm very surprised. He didn't see it, as far as I know. I pointed it out, which was he wanted to reinstitute the, we will put those who didn't speak at the who spoke at the last meeting at the end of the line for the next meeting. And this meant activists who have the most to say are going to get shut up the most. Because they're the ones who are regular attenders of city council meeting, particularly egregious when you have a lot of people who want to speak. What they need to do, of course, is expand oral communication, as the Board of Supervisors does, and as Sandy Brown suggested, get done. And I think Keeley responded to that by saying he will have a conference with the city manager and the city attorney and the city clerk, as though that group could meaningfully make these decisions. You know, I mean, that to me is just the antithesis of real public access and public process. But
yeah. You know, it's so funny. They always act like if the left wants something, that, oh my God, we have to, like, talk to the city lawyer and really figure out if we could be sued for that, even if it's something as meaningless as, like, public comment time. But when they want to, like, get rid of, you know, sweeping changes, there's no problem. You don't have to talk to the lawyer. It's probably fine. Even if we get sued, who gives a shit? Right? It's like the attitude is 100% different. And it's so clear when you've seen these meetings over and over again that there's just a, you know, this is not good faith. It's just selective. They're just playing a theatrical thing when it's our side, and then when it's the other side, everything is, you know, hunky-dory.
Well, you would know, because I know you have been in go-arounds in the last year on issues about involving abusive treatment of people, particularly in vehicles and even oversized vehicles parking. Looks like that kind of issue is being preempted for you by the reality of the OVO ordinance, and you are, as I frankly suggested was likely to happen, having little success with the so-called stakeholder provision. Although you can always cross your fingers and wait 9 months and go back to the Coastal Commission, or you can, you know, put your begging bowl at the door of the local Coastal Commission enforcement staff, whom you can have very good relations with, but I've always found they don't seem to do too much. You want to give us an update on that?
Yeah, you know, everyone I've talked to, in terms of even service providers, do not seem to know if they're going to be in the stakeholder group. So it seems like the city is...
Explain what a stakeholder group is, why it's important, or at least why you think it's important. I, of course, disagree, but that's part of the Coastal Commission's the discussion that allowed them to rubber stamp the OVO in spite of previous Coastal Commission decisions, and it certainly was a substantive issue, and there were some issues that needed to be resolved, and there was a new, economic justice provision that had been added to the Coastal Commission's mandate in 2019 or so, and none of this seemed to have paid much attention to, but you did get the stakeholders group, so explain what that's all about.
And we'll hear Reggie do some explanation of the what he regarded as a hopeful entree, the stakeholder group, which actually has not yet, in my view, proven to be the case, after this musical break. This song is called Chain Store Daisy, and it's from the 30s musical, redone more recently, Pins and Needles.
When I was young, I studied hard and thirsted after knowledge, and often
burned the midnight oil so I could get to college. They told me my fine education would help improve my situation. So then I crammed and crammed till I was almost in a coma, and thesis and examined until I got me a diploma. Aha, they said, now comes admission into a very high position. Out I went and looked around, and Macy's is the place I found. I filled my blanks and application and went for my examination. They took my weight and took my height and tapped my chest and tested my sight, examined my head, took prints of my toes, looked at my teeth and up my nose, examined my throat and measured my hips and even took prints of my fingertips. They made me say ah and told me to grunt, examined my back, examined my front. Then they tested my IQ and asked what I'd like to do. And when that exam was through, what there was to know, Macy's knew. So I got the job. Life is a bitter cup of tea. Now I'm just sales girl 73. I used to be on the daisy chain. Now I'm a chain store daisy. Once they gave me the honor seat. Now I stand up with pains in my feet. I used to be on the daisy chain. Now shoppers drive me crazy. I sell smart but thrifty corsets at $350. Better grade $469. I sell bras and girdles for Mauds and Myrtles to hold in their plump behind this counter. Once I wrote poems, put folks in tears. Now I write checks for ladies' brassieres. I used to be on the daisy chain. Now I'm a chain store daisy. I guess, madame, that's so, madame. Of course, madame, that's the very best. Exactly the kind that's worn by Mae West. For you, madame, we do, madame. That's true, madame. In blue, madame, that one is 1974. It ought to be expensive. It's the largest in the store. Once I had a yearning for all higher learning, studied till I made the grade. I pursued my knowledge and finished college. Well, look at the kind of grade I made. I'm selling things to fit the figure. Make the big things small and the small things bigger. I used to be on the daisy chain.
But you did get the stakeholders group. So explain what that's all about.
So the stakeholder group is supposed to be a group of people opposed to the OVO, mostly unhoused people themselves in vehicles, is explicitly what the commissioner asked for. And somehow, because of the city, has been mutated into 50% for OVO, 50% against. And it seems unclear if the city is even capable of having unhoused voices in such a group. It seems, by all accounts, the city council, like Councilmember Bruner has suggested at least a couple times now, is actively searching for wealthy coastal homeowners, business owners, basically people who are natural supporters of OVO, to be in the stakeholder group and trying to edge out advocates, activists, and even seemingly service providers who are key to implementing OVO in the way that the permit requests.
So, have any service providers actually given you any evidence that they're, you know, or told you they've openly approached the city? I mean, anybody from Housing Matters, from the Salvation Army? I'm thinking of the establishment civil service providers.
Exactly. You know, I need to speak to the Salvation Army still, because I would imagine that that's the one that is most likely on the side of the city. Because from who I've spoken to, AFC is mostly on our side. Free Guide is mostly on our side. Downtown Streets team is mostly on our side. So that really only leaves Salvation Army.
Salvation Army
doesn't do safe parking. They really do encampment stuff.
Have you actually been able to hear that any of those groups have applied for this position or been approached by the city?
None of them have been approached that I've heard.
Have any of them applied?
I don't think that they've tried to, like, actively apply for this kind of...
I mean, the reason I ask is if you go to San Diego and you look at the debates around their... I don't know if it's their OVO. Maybe it's the encampment banning or severe limitations that they were considering recently, a couple of days ago, I think. Lots of service providers weighed in with great concern and some anger even, maybe I'm taking that too far, but there was a lot of criticism of the city's position, not that the city authorities gave much of a damn as far as I know, but they were there in numbers and making their issue public. I've not seen that really ever happen in Santa Cruz, at least not recently. You know, instead these guys just, you know, feed at the trough and away they go. And there's no concern about, you know, the basic implications of this for the much broader homeless community, whether on the ground or in vehicles. What's been your sense of that?
I think the service providers are in a sticky situation because, as you imply, they have no way of getting funding outside of the city and or county who are the ones who are, you know, operating in bad faith. And so it's hard for them to navigate, like, what is, like, a way that they can speak against these entities that are existentially, have existential power over them.
You know, I would encourage you, Reggie, although, you know, I mean, I'm bringing up the issue. It's probably my responsibility, but I'm too lazy to do it, or maybe I'm not. Who knows? But, you know, contact San Diego and find out, aren't those same service providers that are raising their voices equally dependent upon city and county authorities to get their funding? Certainly in urban areas you have more advocate support because you have a more diverse and probably a poorer population in many respects, although I don't even know about that with respect to Santa Cruz. A lot of poverty here, too. But I'm just, you know, I think your claim that this is, you know, you sound like you're running interference for them. You're saying, oh, we got to understand them. You know, they have their problems. I used to, I would say that about people like Brent Adams, who was... But even he would speak out about the real situation. I would continue to urge him to talk about what the real situation is, regardless of, you know, the implications in terms of, you know, getting more money. I think, by the way, I think you should suggest he join a stakeholder group. I mean, I think he may live in a, you know, his complex down there on Felker Street now, but I think he's also, that's not necessarily going to continue. And he certainly has had lots of experience with folks outside.
I mean, my concern with Brent is that he historically has sided with the business owners and the capitalists and the right-wingers against us, and therefore against the homeless community themselves. And so it's hard to...
What are you pointing to? When you say that, what specific positions you feel, and what particular actions are you pointing to historically?
Well, I think, like, basically anything that we do, he criticizes, and he never criticizes Darius. He never criticizes Carol Pahamas. He only joins in on their critiques of us, saying that, oh, we don't give enough Because he believes, as Carol does in many cases, that, like, if we want homeless services, it should be a sort of charitable gift from the class of housed neighbors. Like, housed neighbors should have basically veto power over poor people being in the community, and therefore we should beg the housed neighbors for their...
I've heard this criticism, and I've also perhaps even articulated it myself, you know, but actually in the conversations I've had with them, and if you ever review any of my old shows, you can find that, you know, when I interview him and critique him, it's really a function of he did a lot of activism, and he was betrayed by activists. Mostly, I think he was betrayed by attorneys in terms of the Santa Cruz 11 stuff way back when, which was, for those who don't know, it was the Occupy movement and the city's attempt then to crush activists who really had little to do with the real occupation of the 75 River Street Bank building, but were nonetheless used as scapegoats and dragged through court for a year and punished for stuff that other people did, which wasn't really... You know, the real crimes are still being done by Wells Fargo and these other large banks and other authorities, but that's neither here nor there. Anyway, the reason I raise him is I think his attempt to get the buy-in of the community, that was his big shtick. He felt he could never get, an encampment activity from the government. They were, you know... opposed to it. It had to be done through coalitions with the community. And I am very skeptical of that idea, too. I think you have to keep beating at the door of the... beating at the conscience of the community and beating at the door of the government and mobilizing people who have common interests but just don't realize it yet until things actually start to change. But, you know, I can understand how people can get tired when they see your allies... turned out to have left you in the lurch, and he kind of also, Brent has personality problems that are very, I must say personality problems, he's angry at times and is outspoken in ways that some would regard as, shall we say, as you say, he likes to blame activists a lot, and I tend to just blow that off because I think that's you know, I don't think that's a criticism that isn't really, it isn't made real in terms of his actions. He doesn't discriminate against activists coming over. He lets them into his meetings. He gives free interviews with them. I don't think he's in any way, even on the level of the Salvation Army or the Housing Matters in terms of its accessibility and transparency. He's far more transparent, or was when he worked his operation down there on Felker Street. So, it's because he's been there. He's been homeless, and he spent more time on the ground than any of those clowns have. So you don't want to, I don't think, I would encourage you as an activist who may not have, I'm not sure how long you've been in town. How long have you been in town, Richie?
9 years.
Oh, well, then you've seen him. Have you ever attended any of his meetings or had conversations with him?
I have. You know, I've had a lot of conversations with Brent, honestly. And I've tried to sort of, like, get some sort of... Because, you know, when I first met him, we were friends. And I tried to overlook some of these problems. And like, it's just been, like, one sort of, like, online assault against me and Joy after another. And I eventually just had to block him because he's just, like, it's just nothing but insults and personal attacks on Facebook and Instagram. And there's no communication. There's no, like, I try to go to personal message. He doesn't, like, want to talk. He just wants to attack. So, you know, I just don't see that that's, like, a productive coalition. I think Brent needs to go through some therapy, and then after that, maybe he can, like, you know, do some reconciliation with some folks, and then he can be a valuable member of a coalition, but I think that, like, so much toxicity has happened over the past few years that I just don't think it's helpful. I don't think it's helpful because I don't think Brent even has his everything is just about how upset he is and how, like, you know, oh, people didn't, you know, they didn't appreciate me enough. And it's just also personal, and it has nothing to do with the goal. There's no, like, shared vision of the future, and there's no willingness to, like, work toward a shared vision because Brent just wants to constantly shame and blame. So
I think
that's the problem.
I think there's truth in that, Reggie, but I think, frankly, I prefer getting the shame and blame, and I wasn't getting a breath to the same level you were, though he's attacked me too, you know. One of the main problems of this town is Robert Norris and so forth. You know, I mean, I get that from Kennedy. I got that from council members, and I've gotten that for a long time. And it's just, you know, it's a defensive mechanism, and it's also a form of frustration, and it's also a form of political power, which at least I don't think so much in Brent's part, but in the form of people who are in positions of power. But I'd much rather have that than have phony acquiescence, which is what people in power are really very proficient at. Huffaker is going to kiss your ass all day, but, you know, he's going to continue doing what he does all the time, which is injuring the lives of hundreds of people. That's the problem. Brent does not injure the lives of hundreds of people. What he did was he may upset our feelings and hurt our feelings, and I think inappropriately and foolishly, for sure. But he didn't. Instead, he was providing real services to people that those service agencies would not, albeit, you know, obviously with many rough edges, for sure.
I've never tried to disparage what Brent has done through his services, except for maybe some rumors that I've heard that are very problematic. But I think the crux of the issue is that Brent is just not a team player. And the only times at which he will work coherently with people is when they subordinate to his vision, his projects, his orders, his guidelines. So I think that's because I've never, ever seen Brent work with people not in a leadership capacity. I've never seen that. And in order to be part of, like, a coalition, you need to not be the, like, dictator or the leader. You need to be able to subordinate yourself to, like, a broader group. And stay disciplined to figure out how each member of the group is going to be able to contribute to the shared goal. And it can't be about just personal nonsense. And so that's basically how I feel about it.
And here's another one from Pins and Needles called Mene Mene Tekel.
King of Babylon, Belshazzar, he sat feasting on his golden piazza with his court and concubines, stuffing in fried chicken and imported wines.
Mene, mene, tekel, 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 mene, mene, tekel, you my son.
They sat there at that banquet board, drinking from the vessels of the Lord, big swells of the neighborhood, praising gods of gold and silver, iron and wood.
Mene, mene, tekel, tekel, tekel.
That king of Babylon, Belshazzar, was a mean old razzadazzer. Never paid no income taxes. The big shot of the Babylon Jerusalem axis. He was a tyrant, took delight in starting wars and doing fighting. Sons of Israel, he called scamps. Set them all to making bricks and concentration camps.
Oh, many, many tickle, tickle, tickle. Many, many tickle, you my son. Says so in the Bible, right there in the Bible.
Tribes of Judah from below
heard the saxophones and trumpets blow. Sore and weary laid them down, while Belshazzar's party kept a-going to town.
Many, many tangle, many, many tangle, you.
The guests were shagging, horns were blowing, Lord, how gin and beer and wine was a-flowing. Of a sudden, all was still, everyone stood frozen to the floor with a chill.
Many, many tangle,
plaster and the brick, over by the candlestick, in Belshazzar's banquet hall, a hand was writing, writing slowly on the wall. The king grew pale where he was sitting, fingers wrote and having written, vanished slowly overhead, and this is what the writing of the good Lord said.
Oh, many, many tickle, 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 many, many tickle, you son, says so in the Bible.
The king called all his council table to read the writing, but they weren't able. All his wise men, old and gray, couldn't tell him what the letters had to say.
Many, many tinkle, 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 many, many tinkle, you son.
Belshazzar offered jewels and gold, if the meaning of the words was told. In came Daniel, spurned them all, and for nothing told the bad news on the wall.
Many, many tinkle, tinkle, tinkle.
King, them words mean to stop your flaunting. You've been weighed and you're found wanting. All your days is numbered days. The Lord don't like dictators or dictators' ways. Belshazzar cried out, man, you're lying. But there was no use denying. For he saw those words divine shining out just like a cafeteria sign.
Oh, many, many tickle, tickle, tickle. Many, many tickle, you
now the king of Babylon was slain, but the children of the Lord remained. All his idols turned to rust, crumbled are his kingdom and his power to dust.
Crumbled are his kingdom and his power to dust. Many, many tackle, tackle, tackle. Many, many tackle, you my son. Oh, many, many tackle, tackle, tackle. Many, many tackle, you.
So, for all you non-biblical scholars, many, many tekel uprasan is loosely translated as the writing, the handwriting on the wall, or a portent of, or warning of inevitable misfortune. And the description on one of these Got Questions websites on online says, Daniel 5 tells the story, that's the Holy Bible, or the Holy Bible, as some call it, tells the story of the Babylonian ruler Belshazzar, a rich and debauched king who gave a banquet to his court. During the drunken party, the sacred vessels from the Jewish temple, stolen by Nebuchadnezzar in 586 B.C., were used in a blasphemous manner. At the height of the festivities, a man's hand was seen writing on the wall the mysterious words, many, many tekel upasan. Verse 25. The king was terrified, but no one could understand what the words meant. All attempts at interpretation by Belshazzar's wise men failed until the prophet Daniel was called in. Daniel was one of the captives from Judah brought to Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel was given wisdom from God to read and translate the words, which meant numbered, numbered, weighed, divided. Daniel told the king, here is what these words mean. Mene, God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found wanting. Peres, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Peres is the singular form of uparsan. The Bible never identified what language the words were in. There's more, but that's all I've got the patience and time for, but I like the rhythm. So let's get back to Reggie Meisler and his analysis of the latest shitty council meeting.
It reaffirmed the law and it's going into effect in a month. I haven't read that. I haven't followed that. I left before that happened. That's what happened.
Yeah, but there is a crucial thing that I would like to ask you that Laura said she was going to email you about. I don't know if you got an email from Laura yet.
Not sure. I may not have looked at. Did you get it today or yesterday?
She may not have sent it yet.
Okay.
But the basic idea is, I'm going to preface this by, like, of course, this may not do anything, but this is a tool that is maybe not that hard for us to, like, put in our toolbox. And I think that, like, it'll at least be something that folks can do. And so I wanted to ask if maybe folks from Huff would be interested in doing, like, a count of RVs and buses in the coastal zone. And doing that by, like, basically just as you drive by an RV or bus, just, like, snap a pic and try to make it, like, one picture per vehicle so it's easy for us to count. And we get, like, a good sense of, like, what it looks like so we can deduplicate it against, like, other people's pictures. But the idea is that we want to try to get we want to get a sense of, like, how many OVOs, oversized vehicles, are in the city of Santa Cruz before enforcement has begun. And then after enforcement starts, which is going to be in a month, how many oversized vehicles are there?
Mm-hmm.
And if we can show that the number of oversized vehicles in Santa Cruz has reduced by more than 50%, then we can make a public access argument.
Well, in what sense? You mean, oh, sir, looky here, there's not so much public access. Maybe in a year you'll reconsider? Or what are you thinking?
We could potentially, if we have a consistently low count of oversized vehicles in the city of Santa Cruz, we could make the public access argument in the middle of the pilot program, frankly.
To who? To who?
To the coastal enforcers, coastal director, etc.
You mean the local coastal or the state coastal?
Just email all of them, you know.
Well, you can do that anytime you want, and I encourage you to do that whenever you get new information about abuses. I mean, I think your work has been particularly important in that regard, you know, individually. You know, you did that on your own, and were successful, as we can see by the removal of item 29, whatever it was, the David Street appeal. You remember?
Right. So the way I was able to achieve that, right, is that...
Explain what it is to those who don't know, if you will.
Yeah, so the David Way... basically what happened was the city was quietly trying to restripe parking spaces in the coastal zone so that they were too small for, like, RVs. And they were doing this using a coastal permit that was old and for a specific area that was not David Way.
And you challenged that successfully. They backed off, but then they went and got the OVO, the broader ordinance that allows them to ban vehicles at night throughout the city, including in the coastal zone. And having got that, they didn't need, although they got all kinds of, you know, support from the neighbors, or at least some machine that looked like the neighbors, and the correspondence that went to city council to say, you know, let them stripe. Even though you were successful at the transportation level to get it essentially overturned, but that it didn't matter because the OVO does essentially accomplishes the same thing for larger vehicles.
Yeah, the OVO accomplishes... Well, the thing is that with striping, that's a 24/7 restriction. The oversized vehicle ordinance is only a nighttime restriction, technically.
True, but do we know anything about how how much they wanted to stripe? What was the length of the space they wanted to do?
I'm not sure. That's actually a really good question. I think it was probably going to be an average car, you know, van length or whatever.
What is an average car van? Any sense of that?
You know, probably 20 feet, which is the OVO length.
Hmm.
The thing is, too, is that they weren't just going to do David Way. Once I caught them on David Way and then got the stop signs, or not the stop signs, the overnight no parking signs removed from Delaware Avenue and that whole area on the far west side, because those were unpermitted. What happened was the city manager very quickly tried to quietly restripe that entire area, and that's why I was able to escalate.
And we should add, for those who have forgotten, that the reason those signs were removed, part no parking at night, was because of your pointing out that they had no such permit, and it was in violation of the Coastal Commission's requirements. And so congratulations again for that at least brief interval of amnesty. And I guess in line with that, I want to ask you, have you gotten any more reports of vehicular enforcement or warning or let's say the opposite, leniency and, drinking parties with both the police and the OVO people joining in?
So I've heard of mostly leniency. There is a person who recently told me that they've been getting, like, hyper-targeted all of a sudden, and it might be because that people know that this person was getting some assistance from me. And so I don't know.
Are you intentionally not mentioning his name? Because I won't mention it either if you think he wishes to remain low profile. But
I wouldn't want to mention their name because it sounds like it could be a combination of police and certain unhoused folks in the Delaware area that might be targeting them.
Is this at her or his request?
I don't know if it's at their request, but I think it's probably appropriate to not, like...
Get in touch with him. I'd like to find out if he's concerned. Usually, well, he varies, or she varies. It varies about what they're doing. So, how public this person wants to be. Sometimes the person wants to be very public and speak about it openly. Others, you know, to garner support. Other times, less so. You can find out more, I think I actually got his or her number while you were there last time we stopped at his their residence. I don't know if I still have it. Maybe you should email it to me and I can call them up myself and see what they say.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I'll send you a number. And they can, talk or whatnot.
Anything coming up in the next week or two that people concerned with civil rights for poor people or restored services for poor people should be aware of?
Restored services?
Well, you know, I've been talking about the need. Something I mentioned at the city council yesterday was the lack of shitters that, of course... You know, they've removed, of course, the encampments on Highway 9, but there's been, you know, no restoration of public bathrooms or public, outhouses. That's what they should be called because that's what they are. Porta potties, sort of a nice way, a cute way of putting it. But it's, you know, it lacks the dignity, permanence, sanity, and sterility of bathrooms and the privacy.
Right.
So you had nothing of that. So, services. That's what I mean by restoration of services.
Yeah, I mean, so far it seems like the city's doubling down on the same, you know, shit that they're doing already. So, nothing new on that front, though. So I think as part of OVO, I am trying to just, like, continuously, like, build relationships with the service providers to sort of get the activist community and the service provider community a little bit more tight-knit. Because if we are more tight-knit, then I think there's more possibilities for how we can respond and potentially how service providers can play a role, even if it's not a role that's super public. For instance, like some service providers have been willing to share a lot of information about their clients, you know, if, as long as the client is okay with it. And then this is actually very helpful for us to get, build up our social networks of people who are dealing with unhoused issues, who are, like, in particular subgroups who know other people, and this kind of thing could eventually, lead to just the further radicalization of people who are service providers and people who are closer to, like, the nonprofit world. Because after speaking to these people over the past, like, year or so, a lot of them care a lot, and a lot of them are on the edge of radicalization because they've been around long enough that they've seen the city and county, like, lie and then pretend they didn't lie, and then lie again, and then pretend again that they didn't lie. And so they've seen that cycle happen at least a couple of times. And so I think what they need, though, is someone on the left to help them contextualize why they are observing that.
Translate that into ground-level English, please.
Yeah, basically, I think, like, we as, like, activists and, like, people who have kind of a theoretical perspective as, like, socialists, that, like, the reason we have a different perspective about the reason why things happen, right? It's not just because there's a bad guy in office. It's not just because, you know, people are bigoted or something. That's, like, not, like, the crux of the issue. The crux of the issue, from a socialist perspective, is that there is an incentive to be bigoted. There is an incentive to be a bad politician. And those incentives come from the capitalist system, such as the fact that real estate, residential real estate, is the most valuable asset in our economy. It is the best way for a city to generate tax revenue, because it's the most valuable asset in our economy. Therefore, the more valuable real estate is, the more connected the state and the real estate industry are, and then their interests get more aligned. And so this creates conditions like we can never build public housing. We tie any price-regulated housing we have to subsidy of the real estate sector. For instance, low-income housing tax credit is basically a capitalist subsidy. Section 8 is basically a landlord subsidy for private landlords. And so, you know, this obviously you could speak about this to a lot of depth.
And the deep probing will continue after this musical break.
Story we sing you of everything that came to pass, to Bertha the sewing machine girl, a winsome and class conscious lass, as sweet as the flowers in springtime. She worked at the men's pants machine, her sweetheart close by at another, while union love blossomed serene. One day little Bertha was sewing, not knowing that danger was near.
our villain espied her and paused there beside her, a non-union man with a leer. Oh, it's better with a union man. It's better with a union man. You'll live to regret if you ever forget this motto, proletarian. So always be upon your guard. Be a man to see a union card. You'll never go wrong if you follow this plan. It's better with a union man. Poor sweet innocent little Bertha, she did not suspect that this guy, contrary to all union bylaws, had six other wives on the sly. While Bertha was sowing her wild oats midst black caviar and champagne, her true union lover was waiting at local 16, all in vain. Alas, she forgot all the precepts which for working girls are correct. That non-union cad, he was thoroughly bad. He did just what you all would expect. Oh, it's better with a union man. It's better with a union man. You'll live to regret if you ever forget this motto, proletarian. So always be upon your guard. Demand to see a union card. You'll never go wrong if you follow this plan. It's better with a union man.
And now back to Reggie Meisler's Democratic Socialist Analysis.
There is a reason why these things happen, and if you can explain that system to people as they are observing the contradictions, then they are more likely to understand where a leftist response, they're more likely to understand why a leftist is unwilling to talk to the city in good faith, because we know that there's a level of immovability that I think liberals and even progressives don't understand. They think that there's a certain amount at which this is an individual issue where you can just convince a landlord to be nicer. But, like, the socialist understands that even the nicest landlord on earth is eventually submissive to the fact that they need that money to survive. They've, like, put themselves in the economic position where they have to raise rent. Otherwise, they can't afford to pay their health care. And so that's all there is to it. And so, you know, this isn't about landlords being nice or mean. It's a structural problem. And just like with the police, it's not about whether police are nice or mean. Police have a structural position. They have quotas, even, to protect property over people. And that's just what it is. There's no amount of, like, training or, like, nice conversations you can have to improve that situation. Like, that's why, you know, I and my wife and others are abolitionists, because that's another angle of the socialist.
By abolitionists, you mean abolishing police departments and or at least defunding them.
Yeah, and the prison system.
You know, it might be
structural. Yeah,
I think what you're saying is concisely put, an educational in many respects, but it might also be said differently for people who are of an anarchistic inclination or simply don't think, you know, haven't been to political science classes or reviewed the texts of this and that, or been involved with leftist groups, that it's some people who own most of the wealth and the rest of us who get to pay for their privileges. And that is something that people can see every day, I think, if they're looking. Although maybe not. Maybe it's well concealed, because the ideology, of course, is that we're all equal and everybody has an equal chance. You know, give more power to the government and they'll help you more. That's a leftist perspective in some respects, because you have more likelihood of controlling the government than controlling the corporations. But the fact is, often if the government is so incredibly corrupted that it doesn't work that way, because of the nature of the power structure and the nature of the interconnections. Anyway, this gets more theoretical, but I'm trying to think of. I guess, you know, we're talking about the issue of whether, you know, getting your attempt to get kind of coalitions with social service agencies rather than, let's say, labor unions, students, disabled people as a group, elderly people whose mortgages are running out. I mean, I'm not saying you aren't, you know, I mean, that's, but I'm saying that, people who are feeding off the public trough institutionally, well, I wish you luck with that.
Right. I mean, you know, it's a complicated situation, because that is a systemic contradiction. I think the thing that's interesting about that contradiction, though, is that the service providers emotionally are invested, from what I've seen, in the well-being of the people in their services. And so even though there is a material contradiction, I think the service providers are aware and willing to admit that that material contradiction exists, and I think they're willing to operate separate of those two concepts. I think what's difficult about something like a landlord is that there is no greater purpose there. I mean, you could argue that the greater purpose is if they have a personal relationship with their tenant, then maybe they find a greater purpose there. And then that sometimes plays out in an okay way. But again, I think there's a complexity to the service provider relationship, because it requires you to have an emotional relationship of sorts. Like, you can't effectively provide services unless you care about the people you're providing services to. Whereas if you're a landlord, you can easily, in fact, you're expected to, callously raise rent, callously evict people, callously distrust everyone. And I think that there's an interesting sort of...
Yeah, but the service providers, Reggie, do not operate in a field where they can control and respond to their concerns that are coming from their clients. They are primarily bound by the rules of their institution and the orders of the authorities above them, and not to mention the fact that they need to pay their rent and buy their groceries. So I don't know if I'd agree with you there. So.
I mean, it's a valid criticism. I think that's correct. I just think that there's like a little bit of mobility there, and it's really important if we can get service providers as a coalition to unanimously be against something.
Well, how many have actually quit their jobs, ask yourself, to join people who are standing up for their rights on these issues one way or another? And I don't know. It certainly hasn't happened much recently. Of course, we've had all kinds of problems. But let me once more ask you if there's any events coming up that you, any meetings that you would invite people to come to, entertainments that you think are educational or free for people who are poor, stuff that you might want to comment on.
Nothing is coming to mind. You know, Yesterday, during our own city council meeting, there was a Watsonville city council meeting at the same time, and they were debating tiny homes, and the Watsonville Homeless Union showed up to public comment, as well as, like, a couple people from up here, I think, and I didn't check to see how that turned out. But that's just another thing that would be interesting to keep on the radar is how South County is doing.
Yeah, for sure. If you can, call tomorrow during the Huff meeting and put out your proposal again. I'll make a note of it, and I'll probably mention it, which I usually am ramming through an agenda, usually, which I rattle off as quickly as I can, often too quickly, and ask about your interest in having photographs of individual vehicles and see if you remember to do it. And I'll try to do the same. If you learn more about Watsonville, all the better. If you have got more of events you think people might be interested in, I don't know, maybe a really, really free market coming up again? I'm not sure. This Sunday, I don't know. Although often folks who are outside don't have a lot of places to put their stuff, particularly with the latest demolition crews going around last month. Let me give you the last word, because I'm, frequently interrupting you with, leading questions or leading comments. So anything we've missed that you want to comment on?
I mean, the only thing I think that I think is worth thinking about is if people, one thing that would be helpful, I think, right now is if folks who are living in vehicles who are, feel like they're pretty good at it, if they are at all interested in putting together, a how-to guide and maybe even giving, a location or two. They don't have to give all their sort of secret locations. That would be probably not a great idea. But maybe just a couple locations that are pretty safe, such as Delaware Avenue is pretty safe at this point, as long as you can leave every 2 days. I think that would help folks that are unaware of how to navigate being in vehicle shelter, because that's something that I was talking to someone about recently, is that some people, like students, are really good at navigating it, particularly because they often have access to college resources. But other people who have not had much experience and don't know anyone who has lived in a vehicle before, it's probably a struggle for them to figure out where to go to the bathroom, how to help get tickets paid off, who to reach out to for certain issues, how to deal with car maintenance issues. Maybe there's YouTube channels, I think stuff like that to sort of build, a little community information for people trying to just, survive in vehicles would be a really helpful resource.
Okay. And again, if you get through to me tomorrow, mention that as well. We usually have at least one or two either former or current vehicle dwellers at the meeting, although, not usually more, so that's true. We really need, it was suggested that, and I haven't done anything on this, that I, and perhaps you, and recruit you to do this, make up a flyer to be distributed to people in vehicles, offering some kind of either help, information, gathering time and place with refreshments, where people can, get together, like you did, actually, in the windy Delaware Avenue and wherever the hell that was, up in Schaefer and, the meeting near the De Anza mobile home park that we did a month and a half ago. So. But I think that, organizing that way, particularly what the implications of the new OVO law are, and what your expectations are. If you want to send me some basic talking points, I can try to put it into a flyer, or maybe pass it on to Keith if he's operational these days. I'm not sure if he is. And he might put out a flyer. Of course, you, I think you put out flyers yourselves. You do pretty well, right?
Yeah. I need to do a just a meeting of people in vehicles and do that, like, without the sort of presence of house neighbors. Just sort of focused on people and vehicles. So.
Well, I mean, just start a stakeholders meeting and invite the community to come, but mostly not for debating purposes, but for organizing purposes, you know.
Right, exactly.
Although
yeah.
I'm not a very, I don't, I've never, you know, patted myself on the back as an organizer, so I can't give good advice, and maybe you want to start. I don't believe in closed meetings myself, so I don't do them. But, you know, if you're doing union organizing and you think you're doing going into a hostile community, that might be the way to go. I don't know.
Right.
Well, I've shot my bolt. Are you anything else you want to add?
I think that's it. Yeah, there's a lot to do. I am hopeful that we can make some more connections and maybe eventually, like, lead to some more interesting progress and not fall back into sort of a situation where we all just split off and go our own way and then no peace.
Right, like tonight, for instance, yeah, or today. So, yeah, no, I would share that. I would think that's more likely if we have some kind of regular vehicular get-together. I'm going to review my notes again. I tend to respond when I'm poked rather than when I try to follow my own dictates, because I got too much that I try to give myself to do, and I end up doing, you know, going to watch a good movie or a bad movie or something. So, but yeah, maybe I'll be talking with you or at least listening to you tomorrow if you call in, and I will pass on your message if I can. I don't see why I can't, to the massive multitudes at the Huff meeting.
Yeah. All right, that sounds good.
All righty, man. I'll let you go.
All right. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
From the boiler room in the golf ball factory, there once was a time I worked out on the line, but that ain't the life for me. Not since I got the call at the square dance hall, it's changed my whole life in a way. While they're all manufacturing, I'm back here practicing, dancing the day shift away. Alleman left with the boiler and a grand right and left round the stack. A quick do-si-do to those dials in a row. Check the pressure and promenade back. Got a few more years left as a toiler till I make my retirement pay. Then I'll just roll away with a half a sachet and get my chance to square dance my fool life away. Stare at the gauges all day. Then me and the wife got some juice in our life. We learned to dance at the YMCA.
now the record I play, it reminds me each day, don't let the good life pass you by. Keep the steam pipes red hot, oh, I'm so hot to trot, gonna dance till the day that I die. Singing and manly with the boiler and a grand riding left round the stack. A quick do-si-do to those dials in a row. Check the pressure and promenade back. Got a few more years left as a toiler till I make my retirement. Hey, 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 then I'll just roll away with a half a sachet and get my chance to square dance my fool life away.
I can't really tell you who sang that one, though it's familiar to me. I'm, for some reason, losing a little track of my filing system, so hope you enjoyed it anyway. Now we're going to kind of wander on over to the levee. This is on 27th, a couple of days ago, where I happened to see my old associate, Greg Benston. And he and I had this chat.
So today is the 27th of June, and it's about 5 to 3. I'm down here on the levee path, kind of, near the Dragon Bridge, talking with
Greg Benson.
And Greg, you're hanging around this questionable, unsavory crowd. What's this all about?
They're my friends.
All right.
That's just the way it is. And also, this is an open public space.
For the moment.
For the moment. And we have been approached by police after hours, when it's after dark, and when we had six units come upon four people sitting there.
How long ago?
I'd say, probably 2 to 3 weeks ago.
Okay, and have you been able to use the area at night since?
Well, absolutely. But I kind of made a fool out of myself by... Sometimes when the cops aren't coming at you real hard, you don't have to, like... There's nothing violent or anything.
You gave one of them a big kiss, that's what you
did. No. I was just handing my friends a papaya, and I was like, all I'm doing is... I said, I'm not going to sit on the ground. I'm not going to accept any citation. I'm not going to listen to your disrespectful tone of voice to us. I'm not going to look at you, and I'm not... And I could tell that I was, like, being ridiculous, but then I...
Why were
and
you...
And it wasn't drunk. It was because I was literally just handing my friends a papaya, and the cops roll up until everybody is set on the ground.
It was an inappropriate step.
I thought it was, considering how we had been trying to get people to act somewhat socially appropriate, we know that we're misfits, but...
And how many cops were there?
Six units. Probably eight.
Anyone you recognize?
But not at first. They were youngsters. They did everything right. I kind of got overboard, but they did leave. Because they realized. And here's the difficult point, and I do need to make this. All the absurdity that I'm talking about. It's that when you've done nothing wrong, sometimes. And you're in a wide-open public space. You don't have to worry about getting shot in the dark. People do worry about that. But you just stand up for your rights and say, I'm not going to sit down.
Now, were you asked to sit down?
Yeah, they said, everybody sit down in a row, and we're going to give you citations for this. And they were just being bossy.
What was the crime?
It was after dark, and this was a closed area.
Was it
the guy with the face paint there was there with me, which that doesn't sound good, but
you think his face paint is unattractive?
Actually, he's bettered it. He's made it better. and see how his and his. Well, I'm not going to say his name online, but I saw who's looking at me.
Yeah, I saw it too.
I'm not going to say his name either, though.
We know who he is.
Yes, we all do.
Actually, I don't. But go ahead.
Well, we're going to make him think we do. No. These are my friends.
So my question is,
here's the thing.
My question, Greg, is what? First of all, how long did the stop take?
It was. They swooped in, and it was over in 3 to 4 minutes.
Did everybody else sit down?
They were already sitting down.
Were you the only one standing up?
Yeah. And I did have a papaya in my hand, and
did you offer the cop a piece of papaya?
Well, I said I'm just offering them a papaya, and I said it's chock full of cyanide. And then one person behind me is like, one of the cops, because they all know me, but they were like, Greg, what do you cyanide? I said it's the seeds. It's just the way it is. But that's a poor. What I'm trying to say is, do stand up for your rights, but be clear to the cops, and also recognize their I don't want one of them getting shot because I'm being stupid. They did, but they did hear the...
Why would they get shot because...
Because if they get distracted, because we're fooling around with their lives if we're being like an idiot like I was that night. But at the same time...
You think any of those people were dangerous? Did any of them have weapons? Or is it this way? They didn't have any guns. You may refuse to answer on the grounds of me incinerating you.
I'm just standing with my mouth open wide and staring up in it. To my knowledge, nobody did. But here's the thing.
I want to apologize for bad stops.
We stand up for our rights, but do it in a proper way. What I learned to myself is like they did listen, but I was acting like I was just angry that they would just order us to accept our citations for something that's happening all the time. But it wasn't the, like, blocking the sidewalk. But, and there's something I'll tell you offline that was kind of cool, but, I mean, I just don't want to say it out loud.
What you were saying, Greg, was that you, a female police officer, said sit down, and you said, no, I'm not going to sit down.
And usually I'm pretty damn compliant because in Chicago you get hurt if you don't say something. But
as a response, the superior officer kind of signaled them to cool it and take off. Which could have been because he had other things to do.
Yeah, exactly. And they said, well, actually, we thought that guy matched a warrant or an APB, whatever, and maybe he did, but. I said, that doesn't matter. You still approach us because I'm trying to, sell a concept that we both sides, the cops and us, respect the fuck out of each other, you know? I mean, just be real.
And how is that working for you?
It's gonna. Because the people that are messing up out here on our side, they're hurting. They're hurting the cause. They're hurting the cause.
Excuse me. What about the people who are messing up on their side?
We have... The half-assed avenues of...
Have you ever successfully used such an avenue? In the last 5 years?
No, not in the last 5 years.
Case closed.
Well, I know, but here's the thing. If they... The reality is that we all need to stand up for our rights when we know that something is completely wrong. But there's a proper way to do it, and so I'm not saying the cops right or that
so
I was.
Going to
right.
be the mismanners of etiquette toward the police department.
Yeah, I know. It's well, this is something to think about, though, Robert. It's something for all of us to think about. It's like when we are encountered with police force or any force.
Let me ask you about that. About have you had any problems with police recently? That in terms of citations for sleeping.
Oh, citation. Hey, Stephen. Last night, no citations, and then the other night, there were some bad things going on, they were cool, I had the narc and somebody, and my bag got stolen, but I didn't tell the cops about the bag being stolen, but I was pissed.
Any citations in the last week?
I'm sure there are.
You've heard about?
Yes. I have heard about. And there's, man, missed the best person on the planet that left. I'm not going to mention the name, but somebody that was up on one of the leaders up on Highway 9 and up in the Pogan. And he's politically active. You might have met,
have you
but,
been, have you been back to? Let me ask you. Some folks are wondering where Highway 9 strews have gone. Any particular comment on that?
Their health is deteriorating, and I'm not kidding about this. I'm not. This is what happens when people have established a home and they have what they need to keep themselves healthy and their friends healthy and support each other, and so suddenly they have the social fabric ripped to shreds. And
skip to the answer to the question, could you?
It's fucked.
Of course it's fucked. But the question is, have they moved to other? Have other communities been established that you know of?
Yeah, but not. It takes a while for a community like this to soak into the ground and to have its footprint and to.
What's the largest community that you know currently exists? You don't have to say where or who, but how many people does it include in a single encampment?
Honestly, I have no idea. I could guess, but somebody else, because since I got into the Pathways program, did I tell you about that?
No. Maybe you did, I don't remember.
It's a thing where 65 people from the Benchlands were given, and they're not all from the Benchlands, but it was supposed to be. It was a $2.2 million grant given to 65 of us, even though there were 300 to probably 400 people that actually lived there at one time or another, maybe 500 that lived there at one time or another over the 5 years. In the Benchlands. But they established a fund for 65 people. Based upon, I think, when the city came around and they were doing their little survey, and only 68 people or 65 people said that they wanted to move that second to the armory. And so they took that data as being the decision point that, okay, if they don't want to go to the armory right this second, they don't want city services. And that's preposterous. That's most patently, I mean...
So what about the Pathway program? How'd that go?
Well, it started out, it was just going to be $16,000 that we could use in any way that anything that was getting in our way of getting to permanent housing, which, so if you needed job interview clothes, if you needed...
Gotcha. And what happened,
stuff like that?
What happened with that?
Well, then they realized after a while that half the money would disappear on June 30th. And so suddenly they had and I'm just going to be very frank about this stuff. So suddenly they were meeting a budget deadline that they did not anticipate. And so then they
gave away more money.
So they took, I thought somebody was taking that car. It's yours. There's nobody in it. I'm not even high. I'm not. But, so that $16,000 for the obliterating obstacles, suddenly they're like, well, we're going to move you to hotels for 3 months.
Did they move you to hotels?
Yeah, they did rapidly.
What motel was it?
Rapidly. Even more rapidly than we...
What motel was it?
There's three hotels.
What were they?
I'm not going to say them because I'm going to... The two of them are going to be suffering very badly.
In what way?
Because of the... I'll say it flat out. The Pathways program decided that they were the intercessionary intermediaries, except they were not there. So an intermediary ought to be there. And so they would come in arbitrarily, and I'm not going to mince my words. Pathways screwed up the hotels, two of the hotels, not mine, but the other two screwed up big time, anticipating... treating people like non-humans, non-citizens,
In what form did this mistreat?
I'm not going to go into it because today is when we're formally. I will tell you next week.
Okay.
And I promise, and you can hunt me down. But
Do you have a phone these days, Greg?
Don't even want to go there because
you don't at the moment.
I've got one that I can. It's a Wi-Fi phone, but somebody stole my. Thank you. My personal. Jeremiah. Is that him?
So, why don't I get back to you at another point?
Brilliant. If you were talking to Jeremiah.
He's pointing at me.
I'm not sure.
That's a brilliant.
Not sure. Anyway, I will be getting back to you soon. Wrap it up. Yeah.
Okay. So it's fantastic. We're getting the 3 months in the hotel. It takes a month to decompress from being homeless for multiple years to where you can even think, well, what is a lock on the door? That's fine. But then at that point, and they're giving us $280 a week in food stamp cards, and we were like, this is too much. Can we give back $40 and we'll put it towards food, not bombs? No, it's state mandated, and that's the way it is. But that's a lot of food. But we get, every time they give us the card, the person that gives us the card gives us a tremendous guilt trip. Every single person. That's disgusting. We already have complex.
So you're still in the Pathways program?
Yes, I am. And I decided to go to the County Board of Supervisors meeting instead of getting my $280 of food stamp card today, because I've seen my friends being...
What did you say to them?
Over there?
If you said anything.
It turned out that it was SEIU day, and it was also the head of Monterey, or of Santa Cruz County Health, Gail. Gail's retiring, Gail Newell. Mm-hmm. She did a tremendous job through COVID and stuff. And so I just sat in the back, and I made eye contact and pointed at the Water Soups, because it's not always important to, because I'd already previewed the agenda a couple of days ago. I knew there was nothing on the agenda that pertained directly to us, but you still need to show up occasionally and make sure that they know that we exist.
Now, what do you hear from Cooper and Russell?
I haven't seen Russell for a long time. Cooper, I haven't seen her for like 2 months. I saw her like 3 times in a week. I haven't seen them.
Have you regularly been using Food Not Bombs?
No. Only because...
You have food.
Because there's so much food that I'm...
Well fed.
And they said you can't sell the cards, but you can feed your friends. I've been feeding lots of friends. And
when does your time run out on Pathways?
In terms of the hotel, probably next week or the next week. The assets that are allocated to us, I've got a forensic accountant that's on their ass, and most of the Pathways people have been phenomenal. There's just one person that's fundamental.
Name of the bad actor?
I'm not going to say.
Well, let's leave it there. Yeah. And thank you.
No, I'm not kidding.
I understand. I'm going to get back to you.
Yeah, please do,
later
Robert. Because I do appreciate your show. I appreciate you, and you have to get this information because I'll be too lazy to come find you.
Well, I don't know if I'll find you. I happen to see you.
You have your ways.
But if I see you, we'll talk tomorrow. And we've been talking with
Greg Bankston.
Thank you, Greg.
Santa Cruz. Yep. Thank you.
$1 million and you can't pay the rent. When politicians say they'll help, but it keeps getting worse each time the landlord lobby pulls the strings of the purse. When the human right to housing isn't even part of the debate, you know you're living in a failed state. Of citizens are spending half their lives locked up in a prison for trying to survive. When laws must be broken just to have a place to stay. When the prisons pay the senators to look the other way. If you have to be a criminal to put food upon your plate, you know you're living in a failed state. When you're facing climate breakdown, when trees are all on fire, when half the country's underwater, when a climate change denier runs the nation, and the opposition party votes for oil rigs and pipelines, it's not so much a country as it is a corporation. Buckling under its weight, you know you're living in a failed state. Blow back, and the only thing your leaders common consensus that we need to spend $700 billion before the year's end on a military budget to make America great. You know, you're living in a failed state. When almost every day some psycho with a gun has to open fire on a crowd before it's done. When the music festival becomes a free fire zone, and all they can say is, it's okay now, he was acting alone. Buy some armor, pray to God, and hide behind the gate. You know you're living in a failed state. You know you're living in a failed state. You know you're living in a failed state.
And that was David Rovix from a Trump-era song, although, who knows, we may be living in another Trump era. In fact, we're still living in a Trump era, or a Trident era, or a Bump era, what do you want to call it? Failed State, name of the song. A story from the antiwar.org website, from their blog, Canada's odious history of blocking anti-war voice lives again. And this is by Wes Engler. Sorry, Eves Engler. A campaign to cancel an anti-war speaking tour represents a troubling return to a more repressive Canadian era. People who care about democracy and free speech should be appalled. On June 19th, Dmitry Lascaris began on Making Peace with Russia, One Handshake at a Time. The 10-city tour, organized by the Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network, follows the former Green Party leadership candidate's visit to Russia. Concerned about previous shakedown efforts by the government-backed Ukrainian-Canadian Congress, the UCC, organizers in most cities have made the venue secret until the last minute. To mitigate against disruptions, they also required individuals to purchase tickets in advance. The first stop in London took place without difficulty. I guess that's London in Canada. But the second event in Hamilton was met with an aggressive protest requiring significant security. The Toronto event scheduled for the next evening was canceled at the last minute after the Ontario Public Service Employees Union revoked the room booking, claiming they received threatening emails. The next stop in Winnipeg was held at a third location after two different venues canceled on short notice. For small, all-volunteer groups organizing backup venues and plans is a major burden. The coordinated bid to shutter Lascaris' tour falls on the heels of two leftish Montreal community centers canceling a talk with Université de Montréal history professor Samir Saul, Quebec Green Party leader Alex Tyrrell, and myself, the author, about the war. 3 weeks ago, the head of the UCC also demanded the Toronto Public Library cancel a room booking for an event on the war in the Ukraine and how to stop it. In April, the World Socialist website reported on the UCC's concerted lobbying campaign to shut down opposition voices in the far-right Ukrainian-Canadian Congress, urges Trudeau government to censor anti-war meetings and activists. The campaign to shut down Lascaris' speaking tour reflects a long, odious Canadian history of harassing anti-war voices, which frequently proved prophetic. At the beginning of World War I, Robert Borden's government passed the War Measures Act. It granted the state sweeping powers to imprison almost anyone considered a security act. Hundreds of pacifists and anti-war activists were arrested under the act. The government banned the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, and a dozen other revolutionary or Bolshevik organizations. Public meetings, except for church, held in Ukrainian, Russian, Finnish, and other languages, were outlawed. The War Measures Act empowered the state to imprison entire ethnic groups, which led to the internment of 8,500 mostly Ukrainian Canadians during World War I, as well as hundreds of others who were not in any way affiliated with the enemy. There were at least 24,000 political trials during World War I of individuals accused of being at odds with some element of the war. In Polarity, Patriotism, and Dissent in Great War Canada, 1914 through 1919, Brock Millman writes, By 1917, it would have been rather hard for a Canadian to express any opinion in any way, in any medium, or to be considered to harbor any thought conceivably prejudicial to the government's war policy and not be in danger of persecution, apt to lead to a rather heavy punishment. It could be dangerous even to be acquainted with such a person, particularly if you were a member of one of a number of organizations that from time to time found themselves the particular objects of government loathing. The War Measures Act also allowed censorship and control and suppression of publications, writings, maps, plans, photographs, communication, and means of communication. Over 250 publications were banned by the Press Censors Office, and many books and films were censored. Similar to World War I, during World War II, legislation was used to clamp down on undesirables. The Communist Party of Canada was declared an unlawful association in the spring of 1940, and it stayed that way even after the USSR became a war ally. Empowered to issue their own search warrants, RCMP, Royal Canadian Mounted Police officers, were ordered to arrest members of more than a dozen banned organizations. Hundreds of communists were sent to internment camps. The two highest-profile political detainees were the communist president of the Canadian Seamen's Union, Pat Sullivan, and the mayor of Montreal, Camilleen Houd. Houd was interned without trial for 4 years because he called on Quebec men to ignore the national registration measure introduced by Ottawa. Over 20,000 Japanese Canadians were imprisoned during the war. Thousands of others, including hundreds of Jewish refugees from the Nazis, were also interned. There was formal censorship during World War II. A dozen publications were banned, and at least three corporate dailies, the Vancouver Sun, Le Droit, and Le Soleil, were fined for breaching censorship regulations. Many books were also banned. At its high point, the Department of National Defense Directorate of Censorship oversaw nearly 1,000 employees who mostly opened mail. More than 45 million letters and packages were opened during World War II. During the Korean War, there was censorship in theater, Korea and Japan. More than 17 reporters were expelled and many stories were suppressed. In Canada, government officials also pressured the media to suppress information. In response to gory radio reports, Defense Minister Brooke Claxton asked CBC Chairman Arnold Davidson Dunton, who had been general manager of the World War II Wartime Information Board, to advise radio stations to prioritize propriety, socially proper behavior. After the outbreak of a series of diseases at the start of 1952, China and North Korea accused the U.S. of using biological weapons. Though the claims have neither been conclusively substantiated or disproven, some internal documents are still restricted. In Orienting Canada, Race, Empire, and Trans-Pacific, John Price details Ottawa's authoritarian response to the accusations, some of which were made at the time by Canadian peace groups. When the Ottawa Citizen revealed the British Canadian U.S. military scientists had recently met in Ottawa to discuss biological warfare, External Affairs Minister Lester Pearson wrote the paper's owner to complain and squash the story elsewhere. Price writes, quote, "In reaction to a 2nd of May Ottawa Citizen article revealing that tri-national meetings of military scientists to discuss biological warfare are being held in Ottawa and other Canadian cities, External Affairs Deputy Undersecretary S. Scott Reed noted that Pearson felt such articles played into the hands of communist propagandists, and that he now felt he had to write to Mr. Sotham, the owner of the Citizen, to complain. Omar Salant, head of the Defense Research Board, reported Reed had told Pearson at a meeting to discuss the fallout from the accusation that as soon as he heard of the story, he had taken measures to see that it was not carried further and had it killed in the Ottawa Journal and over the CP wires. On the grounds of national security, the truth about Canadian involvement in biological warfare preparations remained hidden. During the war, Canadian Peace Congress Chairman James Endicott was bitterly denounced for, among other things, accusing the U.S.-led forces of employing biological weapons. Pearson called Endicott, who had been a college friend, a red stooge and the bait on the end of a red hook. Pearson also even called for individuals to destroy the peace conference from the inside. The external minister publicly applauded 50 engineering students who swamped a membership meeting of the University of Toronto Peace Congress branch. He proclaimed, if more Canadians were to show something of this high-spirited crusading zeal, we would very soon hear little of the Canadian Peace Congress and its works. We would simply take it over. Government attacks spurred media and public hostility. A number of public venues refused to rent their space to the Peace Congress, and Endicott's Toronto home was firebombed during a large Peace Congress meeting. Whether or not one agrees with Dmitry Lascaris's position on the Ukraine war, Canadians should oppose bids to return to this country to a time when anti-war positions were actively repressed. It's imperative to stand up to the Ukrainian-Canadian Congress's efforts to shut down critical discussion of Ottawa's role in the war. And that's Canada's odious history of blocking anti-war voice lives again by Eve Engler in the antiwar.org website. And finally, here's another story, again from antiwar.org, the libertarian news site. Zelensky says no elections in Ukraine until the war is over. The Ukrainian leader says elections can't happen under martial law. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky told BBC last week that there will be no Ukrainian presidential election in 2024 if martial law is still in effect, the New Voice of Ukraine reported. Zelensky's five-year term is due to end in 2024, but his comments suggest that it will be extended indefinitely if the war isn't over by then. He made similar comments about Ukraine's parliamentary elections, which are due to be held in October of this year, in an interview with the Washington Post last month. When asked if parliamentary elections will be held this fall, Zelensky said, quote, "If we have martial law, we cannot have elections. The Constitution prohibits any elections during martial law. If there is no martial law, then there will be." Ruslan Stefanchuk, the Speaker of the Ukrainian Parliament, also said this month that elections can't happen in Ukraine under martial law, which Zelensky declared when Russia invaded. Ukrainian legislation stipulates it is impossible to hold any elections during martial law, and this makes sense, he said. Stefanchuk added that if elections happened, it could lead to the rupture of the state, which our enemy is waiting for. That is why I think the most correct and wise decision is to hold elections immediately after the end of martial law. After declaring martial law, Zelensky took steps to consolidate his power, including banning the main opposition in Ukraine's parliament, Opposition Platform for Life, which held 44 seats at the time. He also banned 10 other opposition parties and nationalized the media. And in an earlier story from March of last year by Kyle Anzalone, or Anzalone, not sure which it is, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky banned 11 opposition political parties and nationalized media. Any activities supporting the parties labeled, quote, pro-Russian are now illegal. And the headline is, Zelensky bans political opposition, nationalizes media to create unified information. Axios reports the list of parties now banned include Platform for Life, Charlie Party, Nashi Opposition Bloc, Left Opposition, Union of Left Forces, State, Progressive Socialist Party of Ukraine, Socialist Party of Ukraine, Socialist Party, and Vladimir Soldo Bloc. Platform for Life is Ukraine's largest opposition party and did hold 44 seats in parliament. Last year, the party's leader, Viktor Medvedchuk, was accused of treason and placed under house arrest. Another targeted party, Nashi, is led by Yevgen Muryev. The UK previously accused Muryev of working with Moscow to overthrow the Ukrainian government. However, Muryev was sanctioned by Russia in 2020.